so we're already running late. Okay, anybody here who was at the concert I played before they got here, before you got here? Okay, yeah. Well, you don't count. See, he's a staff member. But yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, that's what I thought. So I've got to play a little catch-up here. And for the very few of you who were here at that concert, I promise this will not be exactly the same. I just want to start off with a ragtime piece by Scott Joplin. It's called Maple Leaf Rag, and we'll talk about that for a minute. And I've got a little audience participation for you, and then we'll get on to some stuff about the blues, which is how this particular event is billed. So here's Scott Joplin's piece, The Maple Leaf Rag, which comes from the year 1899. That was its publication date, and it was published in Missouri. All right, thank you. Thanks very much. That is ragtime, obviously. And as I said, Scott Joplin, I'm playing it because the foundation of all of these, I guess they're some kind of sessions, they're kind of concerts with commentary or something. And the foundation of it is the idea that the rhythm is the most basic ingredient in American music. And it goes way back to the beginning of the history of really pop music in this country, and that would be, at least I think, starts with Maple Leaf Rag in 1899, Scott Joplin's piece. And it's a simple idea that the rhythm is at the basis of it, and then you do sorts of a lot of things that are sort of not exactly on the beat. So you got to have the strong beat so you can play against it or sing against it or whatever you're doing. And simple in ragtime to see what's going on, because the left hand is the timekeeper and the right hand is the one that does all the decorations and the fancy stuff. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to do something now, just to see if it works. It's tough with a Lutheran audience to do something like this, but I think it's worth a try. You know, I have to tell you, it worked pretty good the first time we tried it. It was quite amazing. So I'm thinking of making it more complicated, but maybe not. I'll keep it the way it was. So, and I know there are a couple of you guys who were here before, so you know what's going on here. We're going to start by just clapping. I'll lead you in this, by just clapping a basic timekeeping beat, and then I'll try to get you to accent the beats that a Lutheran audience normally would not. So we're going to count to four, and the natural inclination of most people is to make the strong beats number one and number three, and I'm going to try to get you to do it on number two and number four. It might work. And then I'll make it a little more complicated. But let's do that first. So here we go. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Two. Keep going, and you guys keep this going, you stop and do this. Okay. Two, four, two, four, two, four. Maybe that's as far as we need to go. That is kind of how the whole thing works, rhythmically. I could make it worse. I could split it in three parts, but I think that's good enough. That kind of does it. And that's what Joplin's music, of course, it has specific pitches and melodies and stuff in there, but that's pretty much what it's based on. And I wanted to start with that, with ragtime, because it's a music that has a whole lot of notes in it. But that beat underlies even the most lyrical kind of playing, such as a blues piece that I'm about to play here, which is in the manner of a piano player who played very few notes on some of the things that he played. That was a guy named Jimmy Yancey from Chicago. And just keep in mind that the only reason this is so effective, or one of the big reasons, is because you keep that strong beat in there. It's just the tempo is a little different and the feeling is different, but the rhythm is a huge part of this. And see if you can... That gives you something to think about in case you get tired of listening to the piece of music, I guess. But it's true, very true. Without the rhythm, this kind of thing would not be effective. And this is called How Long Blues. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay, the blues, well, all music really, but the blues certainly is based on singing, which I'm not going to do, but it certainly is based on that. And if you think about it, that means that it might be a little hard to play on the piano. Why? Because the piano has limitations that the human voice does not have. For example, a couple of simple things here. A lot of things make it hard, but I'll just give you two of them. And it's pretty obvious, really. One is, as soon as I play a note, it starts to fade. And no matter how hard I press on that, I'm going to have to hit it again or it's going to be gone. It is frustrating, to tell you the truth. If you're going to sing, you have breath support at least. So until you run out of breath, you can keep it at a constant volume. So that's one thing you have to find a cure for if you're going to try to sound like you're making the piano sing. And another is even more of a problem, and that is, okay, look at the piano. It has lots of notes, 88 notes on there. Is that enough? No, it's not. Why? Because you can't. All you can play are those 88 notes. It's very limiting because you can't get in between those pitches. They're fixed. And so you got to look for ways to make it sound like, at least, like you're sliding the pitches up and down, which the piano is incapable of doing. Well, in the case of sustaining the note, that's easy, and blues players figured out how to do that. It's actually a tradition in keyboard playing. Something like this, maybe. Instead of just pressing on that, to do something like this, or something like that, and you get the illusion of constant pitch. And but the other thing about sliding among the pitches, that's not quite as easy. But the one trick, they do a lot of them, but one trick is just to play a note and hit it, hit the next one down from it. So I've got a white key there. There's a black one. Hit them at the same time and then gradually slide off that lower one, the black one. So it sounds like you're sliding into, if you do it right, sounds like you're sliding into the pitch that's just a little higher. I almost waited too long there because the pitch was almost gone by the time I got there. It works. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's kind of... Those are the two major obstacles. So a guy like Jimmy Yancey was using those two things I showed you and a couple of other things, a lot of effects there that you have to do in order to make it sound like the blues. For instance, take this. This is kind of bland. Okay. What does that sound like? It's a St. Louis blues, but... If you do this, it kind of fixes it up a little bit. Okay, well, this is all. If it seems too elementary, I'm sorry, but I think the simple things are the most important things often, and the most profound things because they're the building blocks for everything else. Okay, I said the rhythm. There's a kind of piano music. It's very much like ragtime, but it's a blues style. It has all these inflections I've been talking about. And that's called Boogie Woogie. As a character who was a very important pianist, at least for the influence he had. He didn't make too many recordings, but he made enough of them so that he kind of defines what the music sounds like nowadays. If you get into this music, you find out about Pine Top Smith. He was from down south, Alabama, and he came up to Chicago in the late 20s because he got an offer to make some recordings up there. So he moved his whole family to Chicago. There was work there, and there was a lot of migration from the south to Chicago during the 20s and from New Orleans and other places in the south by musicians and by many, many other people, not just African Americans in general. We're heading for Chicago, and the musicians were going along to entertain them. So here's Pine Top's tune. He had just a few recordings before he was accidentally killed in a dance hall fight, got shot. less than a year after he did this. Anyway, this is from 1929, and what's the name of it? It's called Jump Steady, Jump Steady Blues. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've been talking about the rhythm, and we were counting to four, and that's not necessarily the case all the time, and I just wanted to give you I'm not going to try to do the whole thing because it's a little bit too long for what we're doing here. It involves all kinds of narration, which I'm not going to do, but there's a character named... It's a good example of some other basis for the rhythm. Wesley Wallace, his name was. He was from St. Louis. And he made, again, very few recordings, but again, he went to Chicago to do it. And I think it was the same year, 1929. And he had one called Number 29. It was all about riding the rails between, I forget, somewhere to get back to St. Louis from someplace. So he talks about it a lot. And the blues has a lot to do with trains, especially in the early days. And they kept trying to make train sounds on the piano and all kinds of things. So he gets this rolling thing going. It's based on not four counts, but six. So it can get a little confusing. But it doesn't matter because it's just him. He doesn't have to worry about anybody trying to keep up with him. So I'll just give you a little bit of what that feeling is like. It's a very headlong kind of thing. It's sort of like a train. Thank you. like perpetual motion or something. I want to just tell you briefly about a couple of guys from New Orleans that had its own kind of blues down there. And we'll start with Jelly Roll Morton, whom I mentioned him in every one of these sessions, but I will not play the same tune twice, don't worry. So if you want to come to anything else, you won't hear this again. This is a piece of his. It's kind of like Ragtime because it has several different sections, just like Maple Leaf Rag has four themes. This one has three, but it's all based on blues. And we can talk about that, the form of this, and why I say it's based on blues after I play it. This is called the Original Jelly Roll Blues. Jelly Roll Morton, and that's based on something I wanted to tell you about next here. The three sections are all based on this kind of format that the blues has. It's based on a verse format with three lines. Some of you probably know this already, but again, it's a simple idea, it's basic, and it's pretty cool. It's three lines, and a good example is the first verse of St. Louis Blues, which I played a little piece of there before. We're going to hear a really good recording of that here in a couple of minutes. It's, I hate to see that evening sun go down. You have this line that you start with. And then you want to think about that for a minute. It gives you time to do so because you repeat it. Say it again. Yes, I hate to see that evening sun go down. And then you've got an answer or an explanation or something that throws a little light on it for the third line. And in the St. Louis Blues, she says, or whomever, but it's going to be a she on the recording. The last line is, makes me think I'm on my last go-around. And, you know, this is all comes from something much earlier than a formal published tune like the St. Louis Blues. It comes from really kind of folk music and folk playing. And who knows exactly how they did it. I'll bet they didn't divide it exactly into these things, but they did make up the words as they were going along, and they were singing about their lives. And it's interesting because the guy who wrote, or published at least, he would put it that way, he wouldn't say he wrote it, was W.C. Handy. And I was going to read something he said. He was an African-American guy, and he wrote St. Louis Blues. That was his most successful publication. Anybody here who's never heard of St. Louis Blues? It's okay if you haven't. But it's an extremely popular tune, and it's Handy's most popular. See, I got his birth and death dates here. You don't care about that. St. Louis Blues, published in 1914. But Handy was he was an African-American guy and very successful in the music business later on in his career after he started trying to publish some of the blues things that he'd been hearing about. It was almost the same kind of culture shock that it must have been for somebody who was Caucasian, you know, something other than African-American, when they first heard some of the music from which this form came, and I don't have time for the whole history, but here's what Handy says about one of his experiences much earlier, 1903, so that's like sometime before he published St. Louis Blues in 1914. He's in a railroad station on his way somewhere, and long delay, long wait between, fell asleep, and something woke him up, and he says, a lean, loose-jointed black man had commenced plunking a guitar beside me while I slept. And as he played, he pressed a knife on the strings of the guitar in a manner popularized by Hawaiian guitarists who used steel bars. The singer repeated the lines three times, what did I just say, accompanying himself on the guitar with the weirdest music I'd ever heard. And it is, really is, exotic. That's W.C. Handy. That's what he said about it. But this verse form, one of my favorites actually is kind of funny, but I mean it can be funny or whatever it is. Think about one other thing. Calypso from Trinidad is actually an art form based on extemporizing your lyrics. So in the case of the blues, that was obviously a big part of it as well, is being able to come up with, sing about what's going on around you at the moment, sing about your life, be funny, be serious, whatever. But one of my favorites, which I think is pretty good, is Louis Armstrong saying this one. He said, I'm going to grab me a picket off somebody's fence. I'm going to grab me a picket off somebody's fence. I'm going to beat you over your big head until you learn some sense. If you can extemporize stuff like that. That's fantastic. All right, well, we're going to listen to this track because I'm already taking up more time than I thought I would. This is, well, there it is. I turned it up a little. Me think of that's the great Bessie Smith. And the horn player was Louis Armstrong. It's all happening in 1925. And as I should have warned you that the reason it sounds a little turgid or something in the background there is because the keyboard instrument was a reed organ. And it kind of works. Armstrong is playing answers to all the phrases that she sings. Most of it was exactly what I was talking about, the three-line verse that has the first line twice and then the answer. And Bessie was born in Chattanooga in 1894, and she only lived to be in her 40s. She was killed in a car accident, or as a result of a car accident, in 1937. She made 160 recordings, these three-minute recordings for Columbia, and she was extraordinarily successful. Back in those days, though, it was the other way around. It was the reverse of what it is now. Nowadays, bands tour to support the sale of recordings, and that's where the money comes from. But back then, she's making the recordings so that when she went on tour, she could get a lot of people to buy tickets. And they toured around, the African-American performers toured around for an outfit, if they were lucky, and got up to the top tier. They were touring for an outfit called the Theater Owners Booking Association, TOBA. They had that was an acronym for some of them, but I can't tell you because we're in a church. But it was kind of tough going, that work. But Bessie traveled with a troupe that sometimes had as many as 50 people in it. And it was a big variety show, and she'd come out at the end all dressed up incredibly regal, and they called her the Empress of the Blues, and she'd sing a few tunes. This idea of the simple form becoming more and more complicated, that, although it sounded simple, was not. It's pretty complex because you've got an instrumental answer to each of the three lines, and it's up to Armstrong to kind of bring each one of the verses to a finale of some kind. It's got to kind of fit what she's singing about. And it can get fairly complex without too much more happening than that. And it is. That's Armstrong as a young man. He was in his early 20s when they did that. And just happened to be in New York. That's where she made most of her recordings. Well, we'll leave Bessie because I have so much more to tell you that I won't have time to tell it all. I should be playing, not talking. But I had to tell you that much. So that's the St. Louis Blues, and here are a couple of other musicians. I mentioned there were two of them from New Orleans. This next one is nowhere near as famous as Jelly Roll Morton, but he was a guy who went right back to the old days, born in the 1880s in New Orleans, and I got to know him a bit. He was still able to play pretty well. He died in the 60s, and he made some recordings, but not many, and you probably can't find them anywhere anyway, and it wasn't until later when he had arthritis. But I've heard tapes and things from earlier, and he had a piece that he wrote especially for one of his students, and he called it the Old New Orleans Blues, which sounds like this. Oh, what's his name? Mineta. Manuel Mineta. They call him Professor, or Fess for short. Piano player from the old days, played in the unsavory district in New Orleans back when that was happening. Thank you. that is kind of a... I like these little flowery decorations. Only in New Orleans. Ornate. Anyway, that takes us through almost all of what I wanted to cover, except I want to play some more. And I had a couple more things by Jimmy Yancey here. This is actually Yancey's version of somebody else's tune that was dedicated to him. And it's better than the other one, so I'll play that. And it's called the Yancey Special, Jimmy Yancey Interpretation. Thank you. Here's another Yancey tune just to show that he can sometimes play more notes. Thank you very much. You know, I'm reserving the last part of these little sessions or whatever you call them for questions, which do not have to have anything to do with the subject matter. I suppose it's all right if they do. But so anybody got any questions? Yes, sir. Yeah. I think it's possible that he did a couple of them back in the day when there was a folio that came out. It was called 15 Standard High Class Rags, and it was published by his publisher, John Stark, in St. Louis. And there were a couple of them in there that just did not sound like the usual kind of hired gun arranger there were two of them. There's one particular called Chrysanthemum, one of Joplin's own tunes, that really is beautifully orchestrated, and a lot of people think it was him, but it doesn't say so There were all 15 of these orchestrations for a small theater orchestra size group, like we heard. You weren't here. Were you here the other night? Yeah, of course you were. Same kind of little theater orchestra, not a big symphony or anything, little kind of thing that would have been playing. But he had much better sounding voicings. He was capable of that kind of work, a good enough musician to do it. And so it was probably him. Anybody else? As I said, about anything in the back.
Have you played any songs by a guy named Professor
Longhair? Yeah, I'm really not a big expert on him. I love his playing, but I can't imitate it because I haven't worked on it. But this is the New Orleans tradition that he's talking about. And Professor Longhair, kind of an inventor of New Orleans blues style piano playing, is completely wonderful genre. New Orleans is incredibly fertile musically. There's so much happening down there, and we're not finished discussing it, unless you don't come back. Anybody else? That's not the same kind of deal, but there really has been some great music out of there, and I'm glad I got to know some of the people who were there. It's a great blues scene that was going on when I first arrived in Minneapolis in the 60s, and with guys like John Kerner and Dave Ray and many others. And I got to know those. I know everybody in town. There's a whole lot of, and of course it's wonderful for classical music there with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and the Minnesota Orchestra and all kinds of chamber music and chamber music series, and phenomenal. Really, it's great. But I'm not sure what you mean by that, what's happening in Minneapolis, but musically, I've been lucky to be from there and to be part of the scene. Yeah.
I was wondering, what's it like to play with the musicians on the Prairie Home Companion?
Well, on the Prairie Home Companion, they got this wonderful house band, which I'm not in anymore, but I'm there often enough to know those guys really well. Briefly, my history with the show is that I was the first pianist they had, and I was there for almost 15 years, and I was the leader of the house band, and it was great because I had wonderful experiences doing that. And then the show was off the air for a while, and Garrison came back and was in New York, and it's complicated. But now there's another house band. I'm still on the show, and the band is really, really good because they can play everything that's required on the show. They can also play some good music. And when I'm there, I usually play clarinet with them. And then if they want any piano features or something, I'll do that. But as long as I'm there, they stick me in the band. And they already got a piano player, so. Yeah.
And in your travels and the festivals and that, do any names stand out? What's this called, the modern blues writers that you're writing the kind of music you're talking about?
Good question. I don't have a good answer, though. I really don't. I'd have to give that some thought. I know they're there, but I don't know who they are. I can't tell you. I'm sorry. Anybody else? Young man? Ah. He says, what are these things? That's a good question. You use them. Okay, see what happens when I play this note. It goes away. But if I push this pedal, it stays there. So that's pretty useful. And the others do stuff too. Oh, sure. But look at this. Look what happens when I do the left one. Everything moves. You know why that? That is because there are hammers in there that hit the strings. And that is the, most people call it the soft pedal. That's what it sounds like without it. Uh-oh, this one doesn't work. It's supposed to be quiet. It's supposed to make it quieter, but this one isn't. Okay, let's see. Appears not to work. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to move it to the side so it doesn't hit the strings the same way. But anyway, that's what that one's for. And the middle one. I wonder. That makes the notes down there. It holds them, but it doesn't hold the top ones. So you can play that and keep it there and do both hands up here. And it sounds fine. But it wouldn't if I did it with this pedal. Just get messy. That would just get messy. So the two outside ones work. Wait a minute. Never mind. The middle one doesn't work. That's what they do. And I'll give you my autograph in a couple minutes. Okay. Okay. Anybody else? Oh, yeah, sorry.
In your surveying music and blues, what's the first evidence of the three-line kind of 12-bar? What is it? What's the first sort of piece that came?
Good, I'm pretty sure it would have been something like a guitarist, but it's probably lost in the past there someplace. Yes, he's asking me about the three-line verse form and where that originated and if I could have any good idea about that. And all I know is it came out of the murky folk history of the music. I can't really say. There's a you're probably familiar with Robert Johnson. Yeah. No. You should. Have you read this book by Elijah Wald? It's something, I can't remember. It's very good. Elijah Wald, he has a whole new interpretation of Robert Johnson. Yes, he was an extremely influential blues player, but not on the early guys. He was actually a product of the early. What he did was a huge influence on people like Eric Clapton and others who, kind of made the great big rock and roll blues slash whatever thing happened later on. And it's kind of convincing. That doesn't mean that Robert Johnson wasn't great. He was, but it just means that he was a product of rather than a creator of the tradition. I think it might be true because the history looks like it.
A quick follow-on to you. Yeah. The Bessie
and
Louis song, St. Louis, was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was the first section, and then there was a contrasting section.
Yes. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's true, and I should have said more about it, but I was trying to... He's talking about the Bessie Smith recording that we heard, and in fact, that does have the three-line form for most of it, but there's a section in the middle that's different, and that section isn't even three lines long. It's something else again, and it's in the minor. That's just a separate kind of strain that is the exception that proves some kind of rule. Handy to put that in there. Pretty effective, yeah. But most of it is based on that 12-bar thing. Three lines. I mean, not 12 bars, three lines. Anybody else? The young man's still waiting for his autograph back there. He's waving the paper at me. And I'm going to be around until Thursday. I have a concert on Thursday night. So you can even wait till then to ask me, I think. So, but if you have anything else right now, I'm ready to answer it. Why don't you stop talking? That should be your question. Let us go. All right, well, thank you all very, very much. I'll see you later.